Hello and welcome to this episode of DebtWire. I'm Hossein Dabiri, Head of Court Reporting at DebtWire EMEA.
And I'm Dawn Grocock, Legal Analyst at DebtWire Europe.
Today, we will be recapping some of the key legal and court developments from the first half of the year. The first half of the year saw a steady flow of distress and restructuring activity, giving rise to some interesting and in some cases groundbreaking legal developments as UK schemes of arrangement and restructuring plans continue to prove popular with domestic and overseas debtors alike. However, we have seen deals become ever more complex, with some workouts spanning multiple jurisdictions and incorporating more than one court process. And the climate is more and more contentious than ever for UK restructurings since the introduction of the UK's restructuring plan tool in 2020. There were a handful of challenge restructuring plans in particular that stand out from the first half of this year. Do you want to briefly recap them, Dawn?
Sure. Thanks, Hossein. In the UK, the most significant decision so far this year was in relation to German real estate group Adler's UK restructuring plan. The decision made legal history in January as the English Court of Appeal allowed an appeal by a group of disgruntled noteholders, overturning the High Court's April 2023 decision to sanction the plan. I won't go over the case in detail here, as it has been very well covered on DebtWire already, and I will drop the relevant links into the show notes. But the case was so significant because it was the first time the UK's restructuring plan tool, which, as you say, Hossein, came into force in 2020, has been considered by the English Appellate Court. The judgment is now the leading authority on UK restructuring plans, and as such, impacts all future plans. In particular, the court's approach to the exercise of its discretion to sanction a plan now differs when a cross-class cramdown is required. And it also seems that market perception of risk has shifted since the decision.
It was certainly an eventful way to start the year, wasn't it? And the impact of Lord Justice Snowden's Adler judgment didn't take long to play out in practice, did it, Dawn?
Not long at all, Hossein. The very next month, the English High Court sanctioned McDermott's UK plan following a heated six-day trial in February, which was the longest restructuring plan sanction hearing that we've seen to date. While Mr. Justice Michael Green applied some of the points raised in the Adler judgment when sanctioning McDermott's plan, a lot of his judgment really does relate to the rather unique circumstances of McDermott's case. And again, we'll link in our commentary to the show notes. In summary, I think McDermott really does serve as a warning to dissenting stakeholders who are essentially trying to put a gun to plan companies' heads, but without actually proposing a sensible alternative solution. The judge was critical of the conduct of the dissenting creditor, and he found it unfortunate that the challenger had been unable to agree to a deal that would have shortened the trial. Another point to note is that the plan in McDermott was part of a wider restructuring effort involving two parallel restructuring plans for the group in the Netherlands under the new Dutch WOA process. This use of interlocking, dual track or parallel processes, depending on which terminology you prefer to use, in different jurisdictions is a key trend emerging from recent workouts that we expect to continue as lawyers strive to ensure a holistic approach.
Let's also talk about the case of Aggregate Holdings, another Germany-focused real estate business. That was another especially interesting case, wasn't it?
Well, the Adler judgment certainly hit Aggregate Holdings hard after it was handed down midway through Aggregate's restructuring plan process. Mr. Justice Richards finally signed off on Aggregate's plan in March after having refused to sanction the plan following the original sanction hearing. The High Court had initially refused to sanction the plan in the form it had been proposed and voted upon, and nor would the judge sanction it there and then in a revised form. Rather, the court convened a new plan meeting to consider an amended plan, ordering under Section 901(c)(4) of the Companies Act that the so-called Tier 2 and junior creditors be disenfranchised from voting, on the basis that they had no genuine economic interest in the company. And the judge proceeded on the basis that should the amended plan be approved by the senior creditors class, then it could actually be sanctioned without the need for a cross-class cram down. Significantly, the original convening order had been made and the vote had been held before the Court of Appeal gave judgment in Adler. The plan had contained a provision under which certain subordinated debt was to be cancelled for no consideration, giving rise to the issue as to whether the plan constituted a compromise or arrangement with subordinated creditors, which was necessary to engage the court's jurisdiction to sanction it. Hence the later amendments to the plan to ensure that it did embody a compromise and arrangement with the subordinated creditors. And that's not it all. In more recent weeks, we have seen a rather novel case which has, in my view, really cemented the contentious climate with a novel security for costs order. Hussein, do you want to tell us more about Consort?
Yes, certainly, Dawn. The status of restructuring plans as litigation really came to a head in Consort Healthcare's restructuring plan saga. Although the sums involved in this case were relatively small, it raised some important and novel points. The key parties in this case were Consort Healthcare, Tameside PLC, and Tameside and Glossop Integrated Care NHS Foundation Trust. The former is a private sector contractor, and the latter, as the name indicates, an NHS trust. So not really your typical creditor in a Part 26A plan or a scheme of arrangement. And the dispute between the two arises from a private finance initiative project company. The trust called the concept of an, quote, NHS cramdown, unquote, novel and somewhat alarming. And they argued that the issues arising in the case were likely to be relevant to other distressed PFI contracts affecting the NHS and other public bodies, bearing in mind that, according to the trust, there are approximately 700 PFI projects with a value in the region of £55 billion across the UK. Now, as you mentioned, a High Court judge ordered Consort Healthcare, which was the company proposing the plan, to provide the Challenger NHS Trust security for its legal costs incurred in the context of the plan. Notably, this is thought to be the first time a creditor has attempted to obtain security for costs either in relation to a UK scheme of arrangement or a restructuring plan. While acknowledging the differences between restructuring plans and general civil litigation, Mr. Justice Richards viewed Consort's plan on its own rather unique facts as a byproduct of adversarial litigation and found letters from the funds which ultimately hold the equity in Consort and were bankrolling the plan as, I quote, self-serving and unconvincing. The judge was also not deterred by suggestions that allowing the security for cost application would open the floodgates in future restructuring plan cases. The sanction hearing was expected to kick off on 15th of July, but the company was said to be unable to give the security for costs, and consequently the restructuring plan was stayed.
Thanks, Hussein. And as well as the security for costs application, the NHS Trust really was attacking the plan from all angles, wasn't it?
Yes, it was certainly throwing everything at its challenge to the plan. The plan was the first attempt by a private finance initiative project company to impose a restructuring plan on a National Health Service Trust. Among other things, the trust argued that the fundamental purpose of the plan was to prevent the trust from exercising the contractual step-in rights that would be available to it in the relevant alternative, and from making further deductions in relation to certain construction defects. It also claimed that the plan was not in the best interests of the communities the trust serves, and that the plan undermined the purpose of a PFI contract, namely, to ensure that the risk associated with the project is borne by the private sector rather than the taxpayer. Another complaint was about clauses. In addition to other grounds of opposition, the trust noted that an unusual feature of the plan was that there were only three plan creditors whose right would be compromised under the plan, and each would vote in a class of its own. The trust's lawyers pointed out that it appeared that both of the other creditors had already agreed to support the plan, and they would presumably be willing to agree to the relevant amendments on a contractual basis. Therefore, the real subject matter of the plan related to the trust and the other creditors' role in the plan was simply to facilitate a cross-class cram down. So that's probably enough talk of challenges for now. We've also seen some more conventional uses of UK schemes and plans this year, haven't we, Dawn?
Yes, definitely. In a somewhat more conventional use of UK restructuring plans, UK fashion retailer Superdry successfully secured sanction of its plan. Although initially it did look like it could face pushback from a landlord creditor, that landlord did not make an appearance before the court at the sanction hearing after reaching a consensual deal with Superdry. And along with retail, which is certainly one sector which is continuing to suffer, the UK casual dining sector has also been feeling the effects of the cost of living crisis. In June, the English High Court approved a restructuring plan for Project Verona Limited, which operates the Wildwood and Dim Tea casual dining restaurants, and which used the UK's restructuring plan tool to rejig its leasehold liabilities. Mr. Justice Jonathan Richards sanctioned that case after listening to the replies to a set of questions he'd previously sent to Project Verona, which mainly related to the fairness of the plan and whether shareholders and the secured creditor were retaining too much of the restructuring surplus at the expense of the unsecured creditors. Significantly, however, in that case, none of the creditors affected by the plan appeared at the sanction hearing to oppose it. I think we'll definitely see more scrutiny of the distribution of the restructuring surplus in future cases. Let's move away from UK schemes and plans now, Hussein, as there have been some other interesting developments. Do you want to run through some of them?
With the ongoing Thames Water saga, there have been some developments in that area as new UK legislation dealing with the special administration regime for regulated water companies was introduced. And we are expecting further strengthening of UK Water Services Regulator Ofwat's powers with the Water Special Measures Bill. In other major events, in June, Mr. Justice Leach delivered a monumental judgment in favour of the joint liquidators of failed UK retailer BHS against some of the former directors of the company, which was famously sold for just £1 by retail tycoon Sir Philip Green to Dominic Chappell some 9 years ago. The award is thought to be the highest value wrongful trading claim under the Insolvency Act 1986. Notably, the Audit Reform and Corporate Governance Bill, which was also referred to in the recent King's speech, along with the water reforms, will bolster audit and corporate governance and reduce the fallout of corporate failures such as BHS. A few days later, Mr. Justice Leach pulled out the sword a second time, if I may put it that way, this time against Dominic Chappell himself, and ordered the former racing driver to pay around £50 million to cover losses BHS incurred before its collapse in 2016. That is just over a year after Chappell bought the company. The judge had some very harsh words for Chappell, saying that he had tried to, I quote, plunder the BHS group whenever possible. The ex-director had been sentenced to 6 years in prison in 2020 over tax evasion. The £50 million order includes £21.5 million for wrongful trading and £17.5 million for breach of fiduciary duty and other additional costs. Another protracted litigation playing out in the Rolls Building in recent years has been the dispute between a number of stakeholders in French fashion retailer SMCPSA and Glass SAS, the corporate trustee for bonds issued by European Top Soho, or ETS, that is SMCP's insolvent parent company. So SMCP is a French group specializing in luxury clothing. It was formed in 2010 through the merger of the brands Sandro, Maje, and Claudie Pierlot, and the company and its parents are affiliated to Chinese entity and group Shandong Ruyi. Recently, a High Court judge in London ordered that shares held by an entity affiliated to owners, that is Shandong Ruyi Group, should be transferred back to the Luxembourg office holder, i.e. the curator, dealing with the insolvency of ETS. Mr. Justice Knowles issued a summary judgment, in this case in response to an application by Glass SAS London branch. Acting as the sole claimant in the court dispute between ETS and a group of its bondholder, Glass is the trustee to 250 million euros of secured exchangeable notes issued by ETS. The debtor, ETS, held 40 million shares, of which 28 million were pledged to the bonds, while another 12 million were unpledged. And Glass was appointed in late 2020 and has been in possession since October 2021 of the pledged shares, whose value was below the total sum due under the bonds. However, the 12 million unpledged shares have eluded the creditors after ETS transferred them to a company affiliated with the daughter of Shandong Ruyi's chairman. The bondholders have been trying to undo transactions which, in their view, have depleted the value of the security they have claims over. The defendant's lawyers had argued that given that further parties are going to be added to the dispute at the coming stages, the court should hold fire and refrain from giving judgment on summary basis. But Knowles J disagreed and ruled that the time was right to decide this aspect of the proceeding. The result of the judgment will be that the disputed shares will be returned to ETS, which is now in control of the curator. What happens to the shares after this is a matter for the curator in the ongoing insolvency proceedings in Luxembourg. The decision, however, will not put an end to the ongoing and lingering legal saga. Remaining to be heard before the court is the trustee's claim against Chen Renchu, the third defendant in the action. And as for next steps, the judge declined the party's request for an expedited hearing, finding that the case's perceived urgency didn't reach the mark required to justify expedition. Meanwhile, in the Netherlands, the Amsterdam District Court approved a legally complex Dutch restructuring plan for BioCity Development Company BV. Significantly, the company changed the governing law of its bonds to Dutch law from English law. And this is interesting because we in the past few years, we have seen the opposite of this, companies changing the governing law to English law. But in this one, it was changed from English law to Dutch law. So quite a lot going on. Just to finish, what do we expect to see in the second half of the year, Dawn?
Well, I think we will see the contentious climate for in-court workouts prevail, with battle lines drawn over, in particular, valuations and questions of the relevant alternative to the scheme or the restructuring plan. And of course, all this serves as an incentive to find out-of-court solutions, particularly as the perception of risk has shifted post-Adler. This is a marked contrast to just a few years ago, before the invention of the restructuring plan tool, when almost all the schemes we were covering here at DebtWire avoided significant challenge. I think we'd occasionally see a minor creditor write to the court, and that was about as exciting as it generally got. So we will see more companies striving for consensual solutions. One UK scheme, IGM Resins this year, was withdrawn after a consensual deal was reached. And other groups, for example, the likes of Ketter, Vitter and Hurtigruten, managed to tie up out-of-court workouts. It will be interesting to see how some current situations, which are really starting to heat up, such as Intrum, play out. It will also be interesting to see to what extent non-UK debtors continue to use UK restructuring tools as other European workout procedures continue to bed in. And of course, we may see further harmonisation of insolvency laws, in particular in the area of directors' duties and filing obligations. I also think we could see other debtors follow in BioCity Development's footsteps by changing the governing law to use procedures such as the Dutch WOA. And we expect to see increased deal complexity and the use of dual-track workouts with the inherent risk of challenge in multiple jurisdictions. In the longer term, there may also be some more developments on recognition, given that the UK joined the Hague Convention, which deals with the recognition and enforcement of foreign judgments and will assist in the enforcement of English judgments in EU member states, although it would remain to be seen exactly how that would apply in relation to restructuring and insolvency cases.
Very interesting. Thank you, Don. A lot to keep our eyes on. But that's probably all we have time for today. Don, nice chatting with you today. And to our audience, thank you for listening to DebtWired. You can download or listen to more episodes of the podcasts on Apple and Spotify.